first reading is a story that many of you probably have heard before. Some of you may not, but this is a story from the Tanakh, the Hebrew Scriptures, specifically from the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures, which was put into final edited form around 500 years before the beginning of our era. It collects a variety of writings from hundreds of years earlier and tries to weave them together into a sensible whole. This is a story in the book of Exodus, Shemot.
A new king arose over Egypt, who knew nothing of the history of Yosef, the Hebrew chamberlain who had once been part of the court. The king said, "There are too many of these Hebrew people now. They may take over. We must make life hard for them." So they oppressed them with forced labor. But still, they increased. So the new regime declared, "Throw every newborn male baby into the Nile River. Let the girls live." Now, a certain man of the clan of Levi married a woman also of that clan, and she conceived and bore a son. He was very beautiful. They managed to hide him for 3 months. When she could no longer manage, she took a wicker basket and waterproofed it with black resin. She put her child in the basket and set it afloat on the Nile. The child's older sister stationed herself nearby to watch where the basket ended up. Now the king's daughter came with her entourage of slaves to bathe in this same river. And she spied the basket in the reeds lining the riverbanks. She sent one of her slaves to fetch the basket. When she opened it, she saw the baby crying. She was moved with compassion and said aloud, "This must be one of the Hebrew babies." The baby's sister heard her say this and came out of the water through the reeds and asked, "Would you like for me to find a wet nurse for this child?" The princess agreed, and so the sister went and brought her mother to the site. And the princess asked the nurse, the princess asked her to nurse the child. When the child was weaned, the mother brought him again to the princess, and she adopted him as her son, calling him Moses.
The second reading comes from a recent essay by Jill Schwendeman, who is the director of youth programs at White Bear Lake Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Matomedi, Minnesota. It's a suburb of Minneapolis.
The most effective teaching is nested within a relational framework. Psychologist Lev Vygotsky identified what he called the zone of proximal development, the range of activities between what a learner can do independently and with assistance. Vygotsky taught that a teacher's role is to help the learners stretch out toward the growing edge of their abilities. Think of the toddler who thrusts her sippy cup toward her father and declares, "Cub!" Intuitively using a process called scaffolding, Dad says, "Yes, honey, that's a cup, a blue cup." Quizzically looking at the cup in her hand, the child repeats, "Boo cub!" The engine of learning is not just her own bold effort, but her relationship with a parent who understands her. A multi-generational religious community recognizes that each person, as well as the congregation as a whole, has a zone of proximal development. As teens and others stretch into new powers of relational skill, so can the congregation itself gain new capacities and powers of choice. Congregations thrive by creating safe environments of mutual accountability, then setting high aspirations and celebrating attempts to reach toward the goals, whether the attempts succeed or fail.
One day, not long ago, I was walking along Broad Street downtown with my friend Darren early in the evening. We were making our way to an art festival housed in brightly lit white canvas tents set along the river down by the Science Museum, COSI. As soon as we crossed the bridge over the Scioto, we both suddenly saw a new sculpture we had never seen before soaring up against the beautiful reds and pinks coloring the sky since sunset. Even in the gathering dark, we could see that the sculpture was of a woman holding a baby high in the air, making a beautiful arc. The large letters at its base told us that the sculpture was created by the world-renowned Columbus sculptor Alfred Tibor. And he called his sculpture Celebration of Life. "Cool," I said out loud to Darren, immediately liking the sculpture all the more because of the title. The phrase Celebration of Life, you see, is very typically Unitarian Universalist. It was first created by von Ogden Vogt, the minister of our first church in Chicago, back in the 1930s, to express our typical attitude toward worship, calling it a celebration of life. When we got closer to the base of the sculpture, we could see a lot more writing in smaller print. A whole story was there, in fact. And when I read it, I was totally blown away that in 11 years of living here in Columbus, I had never heard this story before. Which story? The foundational story of the city of Columbus, Ohio. Here it is. Just a few years after the turn of the 19th century, that is in the very early 1800s, a white man named Lucas Sullivan came to this area from years of having served in the military during the Revolutionary War. He settled at the fork of two rivers and named the whole area where he settled after his hero, Benjamin Franklin. Today, it's still the Columbus neighborhood of Franklinton. He married a white woman, 15 years his junior, named Sarah. They must have had some money because they built a very large house, a brick house. Hard to imagine in 1803, where did the bricks come from? A brick house with 20 rooms. Lucas spent his time surveying the land, outlining the future streets in the town, carving out the blocks that he hoped would grow into a city. His brother, who had immigrated with him from the east, was surveying the land on the east side of the Scioto, what is now downtown Columbus. Now, Lucas and Sarah had children together. A few days, however, after the birth of one of her boys, there was a knock at their door. When they opened it, there on the doorstep was a wicker basket with a newborn baby inside, a black baby, the son of a slave. Sarah Sullivan picked the child up, and hearing it cry, she immediately put it to her own breast. From that day on, she would alternately feed both her own newborn son and the foundling that had arrived on her doorstep. And so the babies grew up as brothers here on the wild frontier. Lucas eventually taught the foundling, whom they named Arthur, everything he knew about surveying, a very important skill on the frontier. When Arthur eventually died, he was buried in the Sullivan family plot. Now, I was so moved when I read this story that I knew immediately I had to bring it into this pulpit. Now, some of you may know the story, but I swear to you, so far, no one who has grown up in Columbus that I personally know outside the church can ever remember having heard this story. Most people remember driving down Sullivan Avenue at some time or another in their life, obviously named after that family. And most everyone I know could tell me that Franklinton is technically older than Columbus. But no one had ever heard the story of the black and white brothers at the very beginning of our history. How typically American not to tell that story. Now, many of us here have heard a similar story, the one found in the Torah about the birth of Moses, the famous story of the king's daughter and the waterproofed basket floating down the Nile, are found in every single children's Bible on the shelves of our libraries. And once a year at least, you can see the story acted out in Cecil B. DeMille's gaudy retelling on our televisions, if you happen to have one. Funny thing is, most historians don't think that this particular story in the Torah is an historical one. You see, in every great Egyptian story, and there are many that have come down to us through the years, like the story of Sinui, for instance, a very famous story in ancient times, the main character's story always begins with him floating down the Nile in a basket. It's sort of the Egyptian literary equivalent of our European ritual story beginning once upon a time. It's how stories were just supposed to begin. It's charming, but it's more mythic in the best sense of that word. Not a false story, but a story that's true in the way that stories are true. It's not solid history, but it's an important story. But this story of Arthur and the Sullivan family is solid history. It's not a form of literature. It's an historical fact. It's also a fact that Sarah Sullivan was a devout Presbyterian. Her husband had a church, a Presbyterian church, obviously, built at her request. It's an historical fact that she was filled with the ideas that she was taught in church, namely that we are all brothers and sisters in Christ, they would have said. She would have heard the scripture on Sunday, "Let the little children come to me." She would have learned the story of Moses, too, and delighted in the tale of a princess who rescued the little slave baby and adopted him as her own. She would have learned that he would grow up one day to set all the slaves of Egypt free. And after church was over, I have to imagine, she would remember, probably with a kind of pain in her heart, that she and her husband kept slaves. Slaves who helped to build their 20-room brick house. And that this baby was born from a slave woman who had slept with one of her husband's surveying assistants and then had died. But I suppose Sarah Sullivan would then also remember that the king's daughter in the Bible story also had kept slaves, and that she did not hesitate, nevertheless, to lift that crying baby high out of his floating basket and find a wet nurse to suckle him until she could adopt the child as her own. Sarah Sullivan would have recognized through that story that the human heart has the power to cross vast distances forbidden us by laws, customs, or traditions, all of which are neatly summed up in the phrase also found in our story this morning, "This is the way we've always done it." This is the way we've always done it. To me, Sarah allowed her spiritual life, Moses freeing slaves, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you," to actually inform and transform her lived life of privilege based on slave ownership. So when she heard the baby cry, her heart cracked open, and like the king's daughter, she bent to pick the baby up. Yet when she was a young girl growing up back east, I have to believe that Sarah heard the same things the two girls in this morning's story were told. "My mama says I shouldn't go to the other side." "My mama says the same thing." But I wonder, having been raised with these warnings, as so many of us were, I wonder if Sarah reasoned as the girls in the story began to reason, cleverly, trickily. "My mother never said nothing about sitting on the fence." "Neither did mine." Wink, wink. And so Sarah, against all social custom, dared to sit on what I can only call a spiritual fence. She sat there with her two sons, one white and one black. Now, look as I did, I couldn't find any evidence, any record anywhere that she and Lucas freed their slaves. But she did indeed, for a fact, raise Arthur as her own son. So though she was clearly born on one side of the fence, she wasn't entirely on one or the other anymore once she did that. She was on the fence. But when the world is divided between them and us, you and I, that color and this color, the thinkers and the feelers, the rich and the poor, the religious and the unreligious, and so forth, then sometimes the only place you can begin is in between, on the fence. Now, you all very well know that the phrase sitting on the fence is a pretty negative judgment in English. If you sit on the fence, you are indecisive. You are wishy-washy. You are not very committed. You have to pick a side. Choose one thing or the other. None of this sounds very congratulatory to me. But the reason I chose the children's story this morning is because it took that negative metaphor and, without any fuss, totally turned it upside down. It was the fence, after all, where the two girls met and befriended each other, a safe place for them to be together, a totally positive outcome, I'd say. Well, the conversations between them didn't fly at first. They had to sit in silence for a while. Maybe they just didn't know what to say. I don't know what to say all the time. Do you? Discomfort in the presence of otherness doesn't just evaporate. The differences and distinctions we were taught to suspect since we were children at the breast don't just vanish by willpower, or they don't wither through some miracle of divine providence. No, I think the reason that Sarah Sullivan's heart cracked open was that she was part of a community, a church, a house of metaphors and stories. And it looked as if she held herself accountable to those metaphors and stories which filled her heart and asked things of her. Because of a baby's cry, she began to shift toward a vision of a world where color didn't matter anymore, and both sides were equally valid. She didn't complete her course of spiritual growth by offering her breast to baby Arthur. That was just the beginning of her process. But I don't know about you, I've never yet met one single person who has achieved complete perfection in this one life. No wonder some Asian religions hold to the idea of many lives. This ancient teaching symbolizes for me that the deepest spiritual growth and ethical depth might very well take more than a mere single life. This is not my personal theology, literally, but I sure appreciate the generosity and good sense embedded in that idea from Asia. I also like the images offered us by Jill Schwendemann in the second reading. She speaks of every significant kind of growth being born in relationship. Think, she asks us, of the toddler who thrusts her sippy cup toward her father and declares, "Cub." Intuitively using a process called scaffolding, Dad says, "Yes, honey, that's a cup. That's a blue cup." Looking quizzically at the cup in her hand, the child repeats, "Boo, cub." The engine of learning is not just her own effort, bold effort, but her relationship with a parent who understands her. What a delightful demonstration of growing together in relationship. The father doesn't scold his daughter because he does indeed know better. He simply echoes what she says and says it again as an adult would say it, letting her figure things out for herself by doing her best to echo what he says. Thus, slowly, step by step, growing into maturity within a safe relationship of respect. Congregations work like that, Jill Schwendeman continues. They thrive by creating safe environments of mutual accountability and then setting high aspirations and celebrating attempts to reach toward the goals, whether the attempts succeed or fail. Those are amazing words to me. High aspirations, you know, like we are all brothers and sisters, no one should be a slave or degraded, the inherent worth of every single person. Then she adds, whether the attempts succeed or fail, we celebrate nonetheless. Wow, there's real humility for you, it seems to me, and a very welcome lack of perfectionism. She thinks it's good to celebrate that we have tried and will keep on trying. And you're right, you heard it. She does use the word celebrate, as in the phrase I taught you at the beginning, the celebration of life, our way of worshiping. But worship isn't just what happens in this so-called worship center. What's happening now is indeed worship, the celebration of life, but it's only one form of it, a developed form created to be beautiful, the one that uses music and poetry, story, color, imagery, visual focus, and rhythm. But worship, the celebration of life, also goes on in other rooms in this building and in other ways. When we relate to each other honestly and kindly in covenant groups, committees, or during the coffee hour. When we gather in peace at a bread meeting or a rally, or even host a joyous dinner in our home for others in the church. Wherever we confront the other, capitalize that so you can make that clear. Whenever we confront the other, another person, another culture, another belief system, another temperament, another generation, another and distinct set of experiences, and cross to the fence that separates us into others, and then to dare to sit on that fence with the other for a while, we begin a process, a relational process that might also be fairly called a form of worship, a real celebration of life. Even, I add, if our relationships begin in silence because we don't know what to say right off the bat, that's okay. However else worship may be described, after all, it's certainly not a competition or a graded exam. Finally, Jill Schwendeman says that a congregation is a place of mutual accountability. What does that mean? It means that we are answerable to each other and are called to support each other in our spiritual growth and in our wrestling with all the questions we have, all of them, even the ones that we may find ourselves resisting. Mutual accountability means we agree to ask each other how we personally relate to all the stories we hear in this place. Stories like that of the Sullivans, or like that of Moses, or like that of the two girls in the story this morning, which ask us to cross borders, reach out, make peace, confront injustice, and welcome the stranger. It means we can respond to any discomfort someone else may feel with a compassion that directly echoes the revolutionary compassion of Sarah Sullivan when she heard that little baby on her doorstep cry for the first time and brought it to her breast. It means we can provide each other through classes, courses, sermons, workshops, and conversations with tools, measurements, and opportunities for self-reflection and for blessing each other. It means taking what we do here very seriously without neglecting to have a good time on the way, celebrating life in joyful as well as weighty ways. I don't know if the sculptor Alfred Tibor thought that his work would call people to a greater accountability to walk their talk. I don't know if he thought those who saw it while walking past, like Darren and I, might take the story of Sarah Sullivan deep inside of our hearts to help transform us. All I know is that I really like the way that that other story, our children's story this morning, finally ended. Remember? After describing the process of initial meeting on the fence, Annie predicts, someday, somebody is going to come along and knock this old fence down. And I nodded. Yeah, I said. Someday. And because we are accountable, not just to each other, but to the larger community as well, I say, here's to the day. Here's to the day, a long time from now. But a day visible in my heart with a light brighter than the noon sun. When even that great meeting place, that healing place, that fence, will itself at last come down. And we can all be face to face, holding hands on the solid, common ground.